I actually love when someone does that because that is someone that is just going to decide to put their judgment on the line, take a personal risk when they think it's in the best interest of the business. I would much rather someone do that and me say, hey, I'd like to have you do differently than to just take their hands off the wheel and go, oh, I don't know what to do and miss an opportunity.
Frankly IT, straight talk for IT leaders everywhere.
Hey, this is Jennifer Tribe, and you're listening to Frankly IT. Yes, it's official. We've flipped to our new name. Before this, of course, we were the Frankly MSP podcast. Now we're Frankly IT. Still frank, still honest, but now for IT leaders, wherever they might be. MSP? Heck yeah. In-house IT team? Yep, you too. Frankly IT is where we'll be talking about everything it takes to run an efficient, high-performing IT team. We're going to be digging into ways to optimize your service desk or help desk, best practices for IT project management, systems, processes, automation, and productivity hacks for helping your technical team do more with less, effective network management and cybersecurity in an age when everything relies on being connected, and technology, business, and industry trends that are changing the way we all work. Thank you again to all our current subscribers and listeners. We love you. And welcome, of course, to the new ears who may be joining us for the first time. We've got a lot to share with you, and I hope it's going to be helpful to you in building and managing an amazing technical team. We kick off this first episode as Frankly IT, talking to Bob McGannon. Bob has a long career in tech under his belt, having spent about 20 years at IBM. These days, however, he's a management consultant and coach, workshop leader, and keynote speaker, and the author of a book called Intelligent Disobedience, The Difference Between Good and Great Leaders. Intelligent disobedience is exactly what we're talking about today, so let's get to it.
You're listening to Frankly IT, brought to you by Avic Networks.
Hi, Bob. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jennifer. It's great to be with you.
Now, you're known for this concept of intelligent disobedience. So tell us what that means.
So the phrase intelligent disobedience comes from the world of seeing eye dogs. You don't want the dog to obey its master's every command because they'll both get hit by a truck. So a dog goes through 12 to 18 months of training to teach it to obey. And then the next 12 to 18 months, teaching it when and how not to obey to protect itself and its master. My concept is in a leadership setting, there's probably the same skill that's needed. Business processes that are effective work, well, let's say 98% of the time, and they yield the outcome that are intended to yield. What happens during the other 2%? What do managers do? What do managers allow their people to do, be it an outage that's not expected, some sort of new idea that surfaces that has to be incorporated, and maybe it came in late, but it's a great idea. I mean, how do you engage in intelligent disobedience to get the best outcome? So that's the concept that I'd love to talk about in the leadership setting for intelligent disobedience.
So this is really about knowing when to not follow the process or not follow the rules.
Exactly. And the intelligent bit also means that you have to be very cognizant of what's going on. You have to understand that what you're doing might be a regulatory requirement, for instance, and you can't vary from it. I mean, right now there's a great focus with COVID-19 on developing a vaccine. And as much as we'd like one quickly to shortcut the process by which we're going to make sure it's safe and its efficacy is there, et cetera, that would not be intelligent disobedience to shortcut that process. You have to follow that. You want to follow that to make sure safety is involved. So it's not only knowing when you can get a better outcome by not following the rules and processes, but also understanding the context and the boundaries around which you can vary from, bend or maybe break that process.
Yeah, now I know you say there are certain things that intelligent disobedience is not, or things that you can't do if you want to be successful with intelligent disobedience. So tell us about some of those.
So I think the first thing is this is not about personal gain. While engaging in intelligent disobedience successfully and getting a better outcome may mean you get some personal gain, that outcome is absolutely for the business, the organization that you work for. It is not for personal gain. The other thing is I am not supporting lying. as a means of some form of disobedience. I certainly am not supporting passive aggressive behavior where you go into a meeting and a new process is put in place and you agree to follow it, you don't complain, and then you don't follow it because you don't agree with it. That's not intelligent disobedience either. Intelligent disobedience in that context might be challenging your manager, challenging the person that's putting this process in place and saying, hey, wait a minute, let's talk about the pros and cons and the potential outcomes that might come from that. So it might be challenging when you normally wouldn't challenge. So that's the intelligent disobedience part. It wouldn't be intelligent disobedience by my definition to just ignore something that you agreed to do or you didn't disagree to do, but your silence indicated that you would comply.
It kind of reminds me of that saying, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So I think what we're talking about here is the wisdom to know the difference, right? And is that a skill that you can teach people, or is it more about giving them permission and space to do those things?
You know, I think, well, certainly giving them permission and space to do those things is part of the equation. I mean, if you try to teach it, or whether it comes inherently in someone's nature, as a leader, you have to give people space to do that. So let's just establish that as a baseline. I do think you can teach this by reinforcing what it is that you're looking for, reinforcing the outcomes, and ultimately giving people permission and the understanding to understand the process enough so they know when that process is not going to yield the outcome it is actually intended to produce. Now, I think intelligent disobedience is a bit of nature and nurture. There's some people who inherently are rule followers, and there are some people that think of the rules as a guide. Some people are focused on process. Other people are focused on the outcome. Now, I don't mean it to sound as binary as that, but when I did the research for my intelligent disobedience book, I talked to some people and they were people that are like, yeah, I'm really hesitant to break the process, but I'm concerned this isn't going to yield the outcome. And other people say, I don't really care about the process when I know that process is not going to yield the outcome. I'm scared not to generate the outcome. You understand the context I'm talking about?
Yeah.
So when some people are focused on the process, other people focus on the outcome. I think one of the other characteristics of this is there are some managers that will give someone a job description and the job description is to execute this process. Now, right. A different manager with a different mindset can say, your job is to create this outcome and the processes are the tools that you use to create that. So even the way you describe someone's role can have a bearing on whether they're going to feel comfortable engaging in intelligent disobedience.
Now, let's talk about this in the context of IT, because I know you've worked for years in an IT environment and it's very structured, right? And they're always hammered about process, SOPs, process, procedure, following the rules. How does intelligent disobedience apply in an environment like that?
Sure. I think there's two things that come to mind, Jennifer, when you put this in an IT context. I think it is really important, for instance, in an IT environment to have a defined architecture and to stick to that architecture, and that you're not going to put a bunch of tools that require a lot of different operating systems and or different levels of different software. If you don't have a standard operating environment for your computers or your desktops or whatever it is you're using, the laptops, particularly in a COVID world, if you don't have a standard operating environment, it becomes nearly impossible to maintain things. However, we would still be on Windows 8 if we didn't change that architecture at one point in time, right? At some point in time, you've got to say, wait a minute, we need to break the rules. We need to do something different. We need to evolve this. So even in a highly standardized, yes, we want to conform so this becomes manageable world, you make changes. And again, when the outcomes that you're expecting don't come forth because of that architecture, don't come forth because of the processes you're using, it's time to engage in intelligent disobedience.
Can you give us some examples of intelligent disobedience in action? It sounds really good in theory, but I imagine at the practical level, it can get a little messy in terms of judging when it's appropriate or how it's appropriate.
Sure. I mean, there's simple acts of intelligent disobedience. There's some interesting things going on the world right now with defunding police departments, which is not the right thing, I don't think. I think there's changes that need to be made. But let me give you a police context. I've talked with people in the police departments about intelligent disobedience. They say, oh, they execute this 30 or 40 times a day. I was like, are you serious? In what context? Well, Bob, I said, we can arrest anybody that jaywalks. We can pull people over for being 1 kilometer, 1 mile above the speed limit. He said, we have the right to do that. That's what the law says we can do, but we don't. You're not following the law. You are following the interest of the law. You are following the intent of the law. You're trying to create an outcome. By the way, I think some of the issues with the police is, and what's happening nowadays is sometimes when that intelligent disobedience doesn't come to play and we're getting a little too zealous about implementing the law. So there's one context of intelligent disobedience. I have seen people in intelligent disobedience turn off systems to see what the impact was going to be because they didn't think it was being used the way the user community thought it was going to be used or the way the certain segments of the customer set were using the system. Just for a couple of minutes, just to see who calls. And it'd be interesting to find out who calls and who doesn't call.
That seems kind of scary to me.
It is a very scary thing. But again, I'm not suggesting that this is something that you just do because you have a wild hair today. Right? go to work and do this. But I've actually had people do that and find that this is a system that someone used very rarely and only during the day and was saying they wanted it available 24/7. We turned it off. They started turning it off overnight for 8 hours and no one said anything, right? And then asking for a business reason as to whether this was available overnight and it's using resources. It was an older system, actually took a bit of maintenance and having people on call and it would generate messages and people would get calls to double check to make sure the system was working when no one was really using it. So you're doing something in the best interest of the business to get a better outcome. I tell this story recently about customer service, and because, you know, many IT organizations have a help desk, service desk, call center, whatever you want to call it. And this is not necessarily directly an IT process, but it gives you an example of where and how intelligent disobedience can help. So I went into a bank with a business that I was selling, and there was an interesting aspect of the sale. I wasn't doing anything illegal. I was just doing something a bit out of the ordinary. And I went through the process of what it is I needed to do. I was talking to an agent at the branch of my bank who'd been there for 15 years and got not one, not two, but 5 customer service awards. And she said, I understand what we need to do. I understand it's in the best interest of the bank and it's in the best interest of you to do this. I'm not sure I have a process to follow to do this. So bear with me. 2 hours, Jennifer. She was looking for the right process to follow. And finally, she gave up. She said, Bob, I'm not even sure how to do this. I just saw the bank branch manager go by. I knew he wasn't here. I couldn't ask him earlier. So let's go talk to him. Talk to him, explain the situation. 20 minutes later, I'm done because he had taken a bit of process A and a bit of process B, made it work and got the outcome that the bank wanted and that I wanted. And I was on my merry way. Now, that is an example of a person who's had 15 years of experience in the bank and 5 customer service awards, was not allowed any latitude for intelligent disobedience. So it took 2 hours of her time. It took 2 hours of a customer's time. It took the bank manager's time when, if that customer service rep had the ability to engage in intelligent disobedience and do a little bit of something different, I could have been in and out of there in, let's say, half an hour instead of 20 minutes because it might have taken her a little longer than the branch manager. Saved her time, saved me time, kept a good customer from being aggravated, and off we all go.
That's an interesting story because it highlights there's really 2 pieces to this, right? There's the ability of the person looking at the situation to identify that the rules as they exist aren't going to work here. So that's one thing. But the second thing is that knowledge that they can go outside of the rules and they will not be punished.
Exactly. I mean, it was interesting. In the middle of this transaction, while the bank, the service person was working with me, I said, can I ask you a question? I'm just curious. I said, is what we're doing here a regulatory constraint or a bank process constraint? And she said, as I understand the regulations, there's nothing at all that we're pushing here. This is all bank process. I said, so you're not trying to follow process because you're afraid you're going to violate a banking regulation? Oh, no, not in this instance, not at all. I was stunned. I was absolutely stunned. She knows the regulations. She could understand the boundaries and the constraints with which she could have executed what it is that I was asking her to do and that she knew it was in the best interest of the bank, but she didn't have the process in hand. She was trying to find it.
So in that instance, do you think it was a failure of culture in giving her the permission, or do you think it was a failure of her understanding that to achieve the outcome, which is good customer service for you, getting you in and out as quickly as possible, she needed to break the rules?
I think it was a failure of culture of the bank, or maybe that particular manager, that particular bank branch manager. I have no way of knowing that for sure. But that's my perception, because I think as soon as the bank manager said, well, we can do this and that, she goes, yeah, you know, that makes a lot of sense. And then she even asked about another thing. So I think she had the toolkit, but she didn't have the key to open the lock to use it. Is definitely the impression that I got.
You're listening to Frankly IT, brought to you by Avic Networks.
So let's say that you're a manager listening to this. You like this idea of intelligent disobedience. You can see the value in implementing it with your team. Where do you start?
So I think you need to assess the character of your people. And there's an entire chapter in my intelligent disobedience book, which goes through various characteristics that I think need to be in place for you to give someone the authority to engage in intelligent disobedience. We talked earlier about whether it's nature or nurture. To a degree, you can teach it, but in some senses, you have to have the right character to be able to do this. I know some people who are beautiful human beings. They're extraordinarily caring, and they may be too caring in some respects because they would give away the store. If someone brought in a story of hardship, they would give away everything in the store to them. Right? Because that's the nature of who they are. Probably not a good candidate for intelligent disobedience, because they would be serving the customer too much. And that customer would start to expect that on a regular basis. And next thing you know, you have a perception issue with your other clients and that sort of thing. So you have to have an appropriate level of compassion, right? Not complete and total compassion. Compassion to the point where you can keep the compassion for your mission and the business needs in good contrast with the compassion that you may have for a customer and their given situation. You understand what I'm saying in that?
Yes. Yeah.
There's a level of ownership that someone has to really feel like they own those outcomes. But again, the level of ownership for generating the outcomes shouldn't be so broad that they don't understand where their job ends and other people's job begins. So they're stepping on other people's toes. So there's a series of characteristics like that. There's some risk thinking. You have to really think in terms of, if I'm going to break the process, I might create a better outcome. That better outcome is going to probably be better in the short term. Is that better outcome and the way you broke the rules going to be the right thing to do in the long run? So there's that risk balance of short to the longer term. So you really want to assess these characteristics. And I don't think intelligent disobedience is something you turn on and off. In the book, I describe four levels of intelligent disobedience, where you give someone a greater degree of latitude in order to execute intelligent disobedience. So you may be able to bend some rules and not others. Then as you proceed along, you might be able to bend all the rules, not break them entirely, but just bend how you do something. A next level beyond that, maybe you can break the rules. And then beyond that would be you as a leader, your second in command, who has all of the intelligent disobedience flexibility that you give yourself. Now, that's rare. That's the person that you ultimately say, I can go to my next job and this person can step into my office and do what I do. Hopefully, we do all grow someone to that point, because that gives us some ability for upward mobility. That's sort of the four stages of intelligent disobedience. And some people can jump right into something other than the first stage because, again, they've just got that nature of being able to do this. Other people, you really have to bring them along more slowly with showing them examples and defining what those boundaries are and where they make sense.
So this really sounds like an individual and tailored plan. It's not like you can just say, hey, team of six people, this is what we're going to do. It needs to be a one-on-one conversation with each person to assess who they are and what they're comfortable with and what level they can operate at.
I don't want to say yes or no to that answer, Jennifer, because it depends on the nature of what it is that you're doing. Let me give you an example why I say that. I certainly think the more advanced levels of intelligent disobedience, where you're giving someone much greater latitude, much broader boundaries, is going to be an individual thing. But I know a logistics manager who worked with his team. This person is in charge of a department that's moving parts and products for his company between like 62 countries. And they have a large set of manufacturing facilities and warehouse facilities around the world. And basically, they want to make sure that all the parts and products are in the right place when they need to be and get them there as cheaply as they possibly can. That's his job. And basically, he's given a set of rules to his entire team. And it said, at any point in time, if you come across a customer that one of our divisions or local logistics manager that calls and says they've got a situation, you know, something broke, there was a fire and four of their products have, you know, no longer usable, whatever the case may be. Instead of calling the manager and going through a set of escalation, the entire team has the flexibility to take some orders from another customer or another client, as long as it's not going to create hardship for that other client. They can spend up to 15% more on the actual freight charge to get it from one place to another. And as long as they don't break the laws for how you have to declare products to customs agencies in the countries in which they do business, they have permission to not follow the standard rules. Now, after the fact, the manager wants to know all of the instances where that was done. You just don't do it and don't tell me. Right. But you don't have to get permission from me to do this. It makes the department very, very efficient to be able to respond to different things. And if you have to get something in an airplane is going to leave in 90 minutes, but you've got someone at the airport saying, I can get it onto this aircraft and it's going to cost 10% more. You don't want to miss the opportunity by someone trying to call somebody else and get permission and that sort of thing, right? That's a blanket instance with a very distinct set of boundaries. Now, I suspect the two team leaders in that team have the ability to do something that's 25% more than standard and not just 10, right? So there's ways in which you can give people more flexibility. But that whole team has got this very solid set of boundaries that they can use to respond to the needs of their business.
I do like that example for the criteria that it gives someone. So if someone's in that role and they're uncertain or uncomfortable with making a decision, they know if it meets these criteria, then I'm okay. I'm not going to get in trouble. Still good for the business. And in fact, I'm encouraged to do that because it's going to result in a better outcome.
And, you know, in reality, I was talking to the manager about this. I said, so one of your people comes forth and said, look, I did this and it was 12% more inspected instead of 10. And he goes, his response is, I actually love when that happens because that's someone doing something that's in their best interest, that they think is in the best interest of the business. That doesn't mean I'll always agree with it because I might say, well, hang on a minute. Let's talk about the nature of the emergency and whether we should have spent anything at all. I think if someone without permission did 20%, he would probably say, okay, hang on, you've overstepped your bounds. And I'm sure he doesn't have a distinct number in his head based on the situation. But he says, I actually love when someone does that because that is someone that is just going to decide to put their judgment on the line, take a personal risk when they think it's in the best interest of the business. I would much rather someone do that and me say, hey, I'd like to have you do differently than to just take their hands off the wheel and go, oh, I don't know what to do and miss an opportunity.
You know, what a great learning opportunity and career development for that person to be able to make those decisions and then review them with your leader and say, okay, let's look at how this turned out.
And Jennifer, let me tell you something that's even more important. Think of the person that goes home from work, knew they had an opportunity to maybe, let's take the logistics example, put a piece of freight on an aircraft, get it there and solve part of their business problems, but it was 8% more expensive and they didn't have the permission to do that. They go home wishing something different. They go home knowing that they couldn't execute their intelligence, apply it to the situation and get a better outcome. Think of what that person's attitude is going to be going home and how their attitude is going to be toward their job versus the person that does 10%, that makes that decision on their own and is going to review it in the morning and get a good call sort of response. Or maybe even the person that decided to push the boundary a little bit and made it 11% or 12% because they were absolutely certain it's in the best interest of the business and have a manager review that with them and say, thank you. That was a good call. How's that person going to feel versus the person that couldn't do anything? What's the morale like? What kind of support for the business do you think they're going to have in the short term and the long term if you're given that kind of support? So I think the ability to allow people to actually execute their intelligence and make decisions that are in the best context of the business when the conditions are right, when the rules are understood, when you know the difference between rules and regulations. So your disobedience is indeed intelligent. I think it's a great retention strategy and a way to encourage your people and then actually engage them in the work and have them feel a sense of ownership.
Yeah, so we've covered empowerment and engagement and agency and growth and retention. I mean, these are all fantastic things in addition to the great outcomes that the business can get, right? We've got some great outcomes both for the individual contributor and for the business.
That's the hope. That's the intent of this. And the book is called The Difference Between Good and Great Leaders because of those additional benefits that intelligent disobedience applied in the right instances, in the right way, and very mindfully can ultimately bring for a manager and their organization.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us today, Bob.
It's my pleasure, Jennifer. Thank you.
That was Bob McGannon, author of Intelligent Disobedience. In addition to his book, Bob has a very nice, very concise video course on LinkedIn Learning that summarizes some of the key points about intelligent disobedience. The course is 12 or 15 videos of a few minutes each. I found them really engaging and fun, and they provided some great takeaways on the topic. So I'll put a link to that course in today's show notes if you want to check that out, as well as a link to Bob's book and his contact info. You'll find the show notes at ovic.com/franklyit/067. That URL again for all of today's links is ovic.com/franklyit/067. And that is a wrap on our very first ever episode of Frankly IT. I'd really love to hear your feedback about the changes we've made, the podcast in general, or this episode in particular. So please consider leaving a comment on the show notes or leaving a review on Apple Podcasts. Your feedback is so valuable to us in understanding how to continue delivering a valuable and helpful show. So I look forward to hearing from you. Till next time, this is Jennifer Tribe. Thanks for listening.
Frankly IT, brought to you by Ovic Networks. Own the network.